Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, August 15th, 2011. I'm pre-recording this show because I'm doing some traveling and I want to get some good interviews in advance, and I'm looking forward to speaking with today's guest. Before I get into that, you know that Congress has been bickering back and forth about cutting the spending, which seems to be a joke, and the Tea Party crowd seems to be hanging in there. I hope they won't sell out. I remember the words of my very successful businessman grandfather, who told me 35 years ago about government at all level. He used to say, let them go broke. Let them go broke, the hell with them, till they learn how to manage money. And this is a nation with all these business schools, top-notch business schools that teach advanced accounting, advanced finance, and these people in Congress can't manage money. I don't get it. Anyway, let's move on to tonight's guest. I am happy to have on board a friend of mine for over 20 years now, my friend Paul. And he's got a good background in science and sociology. He's presently he's a computer scientist working with the Department of the Navy. And by the way, his discussion today, his opinions, what we talk about, have nothing to do with he only represents himself, and they have nothing to do with the Department of the Navy. This is his own personal, subjective take on things. Anyway, back to Paul. He was a computer scientist, worked with the Department of the Navy, has a B.S. in sociology from the University of Houston, an M.S. in computer science from Indiana University. And he has an interest in the dynamics of mass movements that led him to research the environmental movement with an emphasis on the anti-nuclear power movement for a prospective book. He abandoned the book after a couple years of research in order to study computer science, and he's maintained a lifelong interest in the activities of the environmental movement, as well as energy technology, including nuclear power, conventional power, and so-called soft energy alternatives. Now, I myself have referred to my friend Paul many times in the past when I need some scientific wisdom and input, because I am not I'm an idiot in math and science, but I'm a master delegator, and I understand how to diversify and call on the talents of the people that need be. So I've used Paul's information quite a bit in the past when I've been debating people over internet or other friends. I rely on a lot of what Paul has to say because of his experience and his wisdom. So I appreciate that, and thank you for coming on. Paul, are you out there, sir?
Yes, I am, sir.
Thank you for coming on to Third Stream View.
It's a pleasure.
Would you like some tea or coffee?
I should have poured myself some before I sat down.
Well, that's good, because this is self-service. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, not only is Paul a good friend and a man of wisdom, but he has a great sense of humor, which always helps. And, you know, that helps things, even tough things, go a long way. So, Paul, tell us some stuff off the top of your head. What's going on?
Well, since you started out on the subject of the debt, whether or not to raise the debt limit, I read an interesting and semi-serious suggestion this morning. It is being proposed that the Treasury mint two $1 trillion platinum coins and deposit them in the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, and that would immediately solve the debt problem.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. And platinum is a valuable commodity. And, of course, as you probably know, I, as a Austrian economist, if you will, self-proclaimed, self-taught, not only do I stand for the gold standard and silver, but, of course, any other commodity that is accepted by the public in the marketplace. And I think platinum is quite a good
palladium.
Good one.
I happen to like petroleum myself.
Of course, of course. But you
can't bring
put petroleum in the bank.
Well, it's a little hard, but, you know, the United States has got, about a billion barrels or more that is functionally in a bank. It's in a vault, functionally, because, it's been pumped into salt formations, and it's called the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Right. So,
And this maybe gets us a little bit into the topic at hand. Can I say something good about Barack Obama?
If you must.
If I must. A few weeks back, recall that Obama, along with European leaders, said, what we're going to do to deal with high oil prices is we're going to release 60 million barrels of crude from our reserves into the market. Now, Obama was doing it for the wrong reason, but rationally, when oil prices are high, it makes a lot of sense for the United States government to sell this high-priced oil on the open market and then buy oil at a later time. So he did the right thing for the wrong reason, and I think that acts are more important than intentions in this case. So I want to give Obama full credit for doing what I think is the right thing.
But 60 million gallons, sorry, 60 million barrels. I mean, how much does the country use every day?
I'm sorry?
How much does the country use every day?
10, 12 million, I think.
Is that
my
all?
My numbers may be off a little bit because I haven't looked closely at the amounts. But
so,
I mean, basically, what they were talking about, it comes to about 2 million barrels a day on the international market, which supposedly roughly offsets the loss of the Libyan oil. But apropos of oil, there is actually no shortage.
Right.
There's a certain amount of overproduction. Although it's actually been tightening a little bit lately. Strangely enough, after this 60 million is being doled out, 2 million barrels a day.
Well, and of course, the environmentalist movement has hindered the production of or the construction of more refineries, have they not?
Yeah. Generally speaking, the environmental movement really got started in the late 60s, early 70s, and one of the big issues was oil and oil spills.
Right.
Coal burning was another one, but that was the thing that seemed to grab them, and it was happening at about the same time as the Vietnam War was finally beginning to wind down. So
right. You
had a confluence of the anti-war movement winding down and the escalation of this environmental movement. And a lot of the anti-war people or people who had just missed the anti-war movement suddenly found, oh, well, here's this new movement that we can latch on to. And yes, you're exactly correct that it started out with, oh, gee, we hate offshore oil drilling. And that really started in California, and then you began to see it expand. And it also began to turn into anti-nuclear, the anti-nuclear movement. And it kept going from there. And by the end of the 70s, the environmental movement, the anti-coal, anti-nuclear, anti-oil movement had become very, very strong in this country. So it took a It took a period of about 10 years, but they became very strong, and they've become stronger over the years.
You know, shortly after I met you years ago, I was always fascinated by it because you, and I'm not picking on you or judging you at all today, but you came pretty much from the left. You have a sociology background. You came from the left.
No, that's right. And it's interesting. I think we've had the discussion before that I consider myself a libertarian sanity check because I came to libertarianism from a different direction. I came from a very empirical place.
That's fine.
And most of the libertarians I know have read Lysander Spooner and Ayn Rand and the various libertarian philosophers and economists, the Austrians and so forth. And I, until fairly recently, I was grotesquely underread in those areas. But I kind of figured it out for myself. And this whole topic of energy is really key in here because for me, my brand of liberalism was what you would call a technocratic variant.
Science.
I'm sorry, what'd you think?
You put a big emphasis on science.
Yeah.
Regardless of somebody's political background.
Yeah, the essence of my approach was that you need to have scientists, engineers, technical people who become the bureaucrats. The government, the Congress will pass laws to create agencies composed of experts who will then render decisions, since these decisions should be completely apolitical.
Correct.
And that these sort of bureaucratic philosopher kings who would understand the science and the engineering would be the ones who would make the decisions. It should not be a quote democratic unquote decision.
Right.
And so that was my position. And over time, what I discovered was that there are no bureaucratic philosopher kings. They are venal and petty and power crazed and irrational, as indeed we all are to a greater or lesser degree. And so it was through the 80s, I guess, it was a period of a progressive period of disillusionment where I backed away from that. And if I could toss out one more thing, and this brings us kind of back to the issue of energy and nuclear, and that is, for me, the model of a proper technocracy was France. Because in France, well, they didn't tolerate these environmentalists. You couldn't have public comment, you couldn't have any interference with the technocrats. The technocrats say, we're going to build a nuclear power plant here. And guess what? 3 years later, they had a nuclear power plant. Couldn't stop it. And so to me, that was the way technocracy should work. Now, France has other problems, as you know, I subsequently learned, but at least in that sense, I was thinking, well, why can't the United States be like France? And then, of course, over time, I realized that you can't practically have a technocracy, even if every now and then there are isolated instances when a technocratic approach can actually work.
Well,
but you know that, of course.
Well, yeah, but I was fascinated shortly after meeting you how you were put off by the way you were treated by the left, or if you will, or the anti-nuke crowd, where they just turned their backs on science and reason and technology, sort of like in a blanket form, and you felt probably hurt and insulted, like, wait a minute, you know, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and of course, there's a great irony, which we've talked about before, and that is that when I was doing this research, one of the pieces of information that I came across back in the late 70s was that there was growing scientific evidence that human contribution to atmospheric CO2 could affect the climate and could cause warming over and above the natural background. And by the early 80s, it would be safe to say that I was a supporter of the idea that human activity would increase global temperatures. And so when I would talk to Annie Nukes, I would say, hey, don't you know anything about the possibility of global warming? We should be building nuclear power plants. It's the most environmental approach possible. And they looked at me like I was out of my mind. And of course, the ultimate irony is that over the past 10 years, my position on global warming has changed because more data has come in, and now it appears as though it's not that big a deal.
Well, that's what I think. And philosophically, and I'm fond of saying this, is that the environmentalist crowd, or the radical environmentalist crowd, and the climate change crowd, formerly known as the global warming crowd, which I guess had to change their moniker to allow for global cooling, you know, to me, it has become a secular religion. It's their secular religion. Bill Maher is one of the worst offenders of this. And to oppose it, to disagree or to question it, oh, you're a heretic. You're suddenly treated like the church in, you know, centuries ago treated people. And you're ridiculed and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. But what comes to mind here is that you know, this old simplistic saying about truth, and this has to do with probably your feelings on nuclear power and energy and global climate change, whatever term we choose to use, right, Paul. But about truth passes through three stages: ridicule, opposition, and self-evident. So maybe, you know, years from now, these former opponents of where you're coming from are going to come to the realization of, Paul was right. And you used to say to me two words I thought were brilliant, very, very, very simplistic. But when I used to ask you about what about, you know, windmills, solar power, alternative energy, you always used to say, build them.
Yeah.
That's what you used to say. That's only two words. And I thought, that's great. And so I would tell that to environmentalist friends or that kind of crowd. And they were a little taken aback. It's funny how they're taken aback because a lot of them are so clueless about stuff. They remind me of a lot of the Obama, pro-Obama crowd who, or this type of anti-business crowd that have never met a payroll, have never run a business, pretty much clueless about these things, but yet they're on their soapbox, you know, putting it down or talking about it, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in this, in the debates and the discussions that have been going on, Obama was talking about how evil the oil companies are, and how, gee, we have all of these tax breaks that go to the oil companies. And I'm heavily invested in oil, but strangely enough, if we took Obama at his word and Congress went along and said, yes, let's get rid of all the tax breaks for oil companies, I would be all for that if at the same time we would get rid of all tax breaks for alternative energy. So we would get rid of the ethanol subsidy, we would get rid of windmill subsidies, we would get rid of photovoltaic subsidies, all the green energy stuff. And what would end up would be that all the oil companies would pass on the tax, what would in effect be a tax increase, they would pass it on to consumers. So you're actually taxing consumers, but I, as a stockholder in Exxon, it wouldn't hurt me at all because people are still going to use the oil. On the other hand, these green energy technologies, which cannot compete in the free market, would go under. And I see that. Hey, that's a net benefit.
True. Well, you probably know, based on my brilliant masterpiece, my secession solution was I would get rid of, you know, all tax loopholes and blah, 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 blah. I would just have a 2% corporate tax, just a 2% tax. Why bail people out? Give them a micro tax and let the economy flourish so that if Paul wants to set up an alternative energy company, he's only got a 2% tax. He has no barriers to market entry.
Yeah. Yeah, now, I mean, basically, Well, I don't remember who said the power to tax is the power to destroy.
Probably a lot of people.
Probably a lot of people, yeah. But it's really true. And now, certainly in the case of taxes for established corporations like General Electric or Exxon or you know, any other big company, well, they pass it on to the consumer.
Exactly.
I'm sorry?
I mean, hello, I don't mean you, but, you know, John Q.
Yeah.
Public, hello.
Yeah. So, for the established companies, the tax probably doesn't have much of an impact. A 2% tax probably wouldn't constitute much of an entry barrier, which I think is your point. Although,
right.
I personally would just say, no tax. My personal orientation is, let's just have a sales tax and leave it at that. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to quibble about tax policy.
Right. Well, my whole thing, Paul, is with a micro tax, that way the liberals won't completely wet their pants because there'll be some taxes.
Yeah. Right.
Of course, I want hardly any federal taxes. I want the taxes to stay in the states. You know, local and state to fund the bare minimum of things we need. And then let's let all this other money be freed up for entrepreneurs, because there's the Austrian economics I mix in with your science, is that entrepreneurs drive the economy. We need more entrepreneurs. We don't need more politicians and bureaucrats. You know, entrepreneurs are the people who make things better for us. Yes, they become wealthy, but we benefit from it, thank goodness.
Yeah. So, are there particular areas you want to delve into? You want to talk about more about global warming? You want to talk about nuclear power?
Here's what I want to do. Thank you. I'm going to do this sort of in reverse, Paul. My main thing, and this is the question I get, and I don't know enough about it. You know, I am basically pro-nuke. I've been pro-nuke ever since we met. But my question, and this is the thing that most people are concerned about, is how do we deal with the waste and liability? Now, you mentioned France wouldn't tolerate. Well, you know, I would tolerate dissent or protest mixed with scientific truth. But how do we deal with the waste?
That's an excellent question. Let me try and give you the short answer.
Please do.
Okay. Here's the short answer. About 35 years ago, the French in developing their nuclear program were casting about for sources of uranium, and there were very rich sources of uranium ore in Gabon, in Africa, West Africa.
Former French colony.
Yep, former French colony, and so the French were mining this uranium ore, and they discovered that it was depleted in uranium-235, which is the fissile part of uranium. That's what makes your reactor go. And eventually, it was determined that the ore was depleted in uranium-235 because almost 2 billion years ago, when the enrichment of natural uranium was higher than it is today, a natural fission reactor was operating in these ore bodies. And that meant that the uranium was slowly being consumed. Well, at the same time, it was producing waste. And they could study the behavior of nuclear waste, which had long ago decayed down to neutral isotopes, but they could determine how radioactive waste moved in a geologic formation. And the important thing that you need to bear in mind here is the only way that a reactor like this could work is if water, groundwater, were passing through the ore body. So you need that water in order to thermalize the neutrons and cause a fission reaction. So what we had was the laboratory of nature provided us with a picture of exactly what happens if you have water come through, water flowing through a nuclear waste repository. And what it showed was the waste stays on site. So nature showed us that. And all the French have done with their approach is they're just mimicking nature. So they use what's called a multi-barrier disposal in crystalline rock. That's what they do. They store the waste in pools of water. Shortly after it's discharged from the reactor, they allow it to cool down. They allow the high-level radioactive elements to decay. And then once the most radioactive elements have decayed down, then they're ready to dispose of it. So,
how do they dispose of it?
Actually, very well, how waste behaves. So that's the basic answer. How do you deal with keeping waste contained? Well, nature did it for 2 billion years.
Now, when they store it, that doesn't dissipate through the groundwater, and then you said dispose of it. Then how do they dispose of it?
You bury it in the ground is probably the best way to do it. No, uh-huh. Actually, there are other ways of doing it, too, but I'm giving you what is the basic conventional approach.
And do the French tend to bury it close to where the reactor sites are?
I'm not quite sure where the French are on this, but I think that they either are or about to begin disposing in crystalline rock formations. And I think they're only going to have one repository, although don't hold me on that. But the thing is, the amount of waste that's produced by a nuclear reactor relative to the power output is so small. It's very easy to contemplate having the entire waste production from the French nuclear program go into one site. It's all very concentrated. Of course, the other thing you can do is you can just recycle the waste through the reactor and just burn it up. Now, there
that
are advanced
like
reactor
idea.
Designs that were originally
that
developed in the United
good.
States that would consume the waste sort of continuously. It just recycles the waste back into the reactor and burns it up.
Now, Paul, same question, but next door, how does Germany dispose of their nuclear waste?
I don't believe that Germany is disposing.
They're reburning it?
No. See, here's the problem. The problem is that most of the reactors in the world are of one of two types. They're in the broad general category of what are called light water reactors. That means that they use regular water that circulates through the reactor core. And either in one type of design, the pressure is a little lower and the temperature is a little lower, and the water is allowed to boil as it goes through. Are called boiling water reactors.
Is that what Japan has?
Japan, that's correct. Japan has boiling water reactors. The other type is called a pressurized water reactor. The temperature is a little higher, and the pressures are higher, and the water is not allowed to boil. And most of the reactors in the United States are pressurized, although there's some boiling water reactors. I believe all the reactors in Germany are pressurized water reactors.
And you favor those over the other?
Well, I probably have studied pressurized water reactors much more than boiling water reactors. The conventional wisdom was that boiling water reactors were a little safer. Based upon my study, I didn't draw that conclusion. Generally speaking, if it were up to me, once again, if I were the technocrat making the decision, do we build a pressurized water reactor or a boiling water reactor, I'd build a pressurized water reactor. But okay. The difference is not that significant.
Okay.
But to get back to your question, what do the Germans do? As far as I know, they do what we in the United States do, and that is that they discharge their spent fuel and put it into ponds that are coextensive with the reactor facility. and the fuel rods are then allowed to decay over X amount of time. So it's called it's basically they have these ponds that maybe they're borated water or something. But anyway, they keep the waste right there, and that was the case in the Fukushima Daiichi plants. They were storing the fuel on site, and it actually kind of makes sense to do an initial storing of the fuel on site so that the radioactivity dies down some before you ship it off to be reprocessed. The Japanese reprocess their fuel, if I recall.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure they do. And what they do is they extract the fission products from the fuel, and they separate out the plutonium and the uranium-235 and the uranium-238, and they recycle the plutonium and the uranium into new fuel, and they feed that back into the reactor. That's called mixed oxide fuel. And the idea there is that you don't bury the plutonium into the ground, so that might have a proliferation advantage, though I don't buy that. But the other thing is, the idea is, we make the fuel go longer because we're making plutonium, so let's burn it in our reactor. So that's what the Japanese do.
So a lot of your research that you've done with your science background about nukes and nuclear power has pretty much been on your own. You didn't have I think like myself, you are your own policy wonk. Paul doesn't have millions of dollars in government grants to study.
No.
Paul knows about libraries and the internet.
Yeah. I basically lived at the Cornell Library for 2 years.
Good for you. Now, another question. I have another question. I don't mean to pry.
Sure.
Even a yes or no answer works. Your current employment with the Department of the Navy, does any of that revolve around the nuclear power?
No.
Oh, okay.
Electronic warfare.
Oh, okay. Now, back to the nuclear thing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say also, and I speak now more like as an economist, and because I'm not a math or science guy, you know that. But if I was running the show, for example, I would obviously call on those kind of people, especially guys like you who aren't these radical, I hate to use the word tree hugger, but that kind of crowd. Now, a lot of these nukes are 40 years old, I don't know, maybe 45 years old. So we've also harmed ourselves, haven't we not, in all this time of not building new ones, of learning about more technology, of more evolving technology on our own? Because we have to look towards France and Germany now, which I'm all in favor of. But haven't we sort of cut our own nose off, in a sense, here, research-wise?
Yeah, that you raise a good point, because
I usually do. Thank you.
Yeah. It's true that up until the past few months, six to 8 months, the United States had not issued a new license to build a nuclear power plant since 78, 79, something like that. It was around the time of Three Mile Island. And after that, there were no further licenses issued.
So let me
say something something else good about Barack Obama.
Oh, please.
So this is two things good in one show. The Obama administration has actually been very nuclear friendly.
Amazingly.
For that, which we need not go into unless you want. But the Obama administration, I believe, has now issued 4 licenses to, I think it's the Southern Company, to build brand new AP1000 pressurized water reactors. These are advanced pressurized water reactors that incorporate what's called passive cooling. So if you shut the reactor down, anytime you shut a reactor down, there's residual heat that is generated from the radioactive decay products. And you need to dissipate that heat lest you have the fuel melting. So the problem with Fukushima Daiichi was they did an initial shutdown of the reactors, but then they lost power generation, which was needed to circulate water to keep the fuel cool while the most intensely radioactive nuclides were decaying and keeping the heat elevated. Well, these advanced AP1000s, and there's a boiling water equivalent, they don't need to have the pumps working. Just natural convection through the core is sufficient to cool them, which makes them intrinsically much, much safer. So a Fukushima Daiichi-type accident cannot happen with those kinds of reactors.
Interesting.
And are the reactors that are to be built by the Southern Company. And as I say, the Obama administration is proving itself by its actions. It doesn't matter what the motives are, but by its actions, it's proving itself to be the most pro-nuclear administration since before Jerry Ford.
Would you say that the movie China Syndrome did a lot as far as being destructive as the construction for the construction of new nuclear plants?
I don't know what effect it really had. It certainly played into the anti-nuke hysteria of the time.
And more protests, right?
It was really the China Syndrome. I don't know if you ever actually saw it, but it was really more an anti-corporate movie than an anti-nuclear movie.
Right.
Though that's par for the course for Hollywood. They did have an anti-nuke guy who talked about the usual hysterical view that if there were a nuclear meltdown, it would kill 30,000 people in the surrounding area, and it would contaminate an area the size of Pennsylvania. And we know if one looks at the objective data, that isn't even close to being true. We had three nuclear reactors melt down in Japan, three of them, and in terms of the effect on the populace of Japan, the effect is, for all intents and purposes, nil. And by far the worst accident was the Chernobyl accident.
True.
And in that accident, most of the contents of the core were distributed all around the countryside because it had no containment and there was a fire that basically released just about all of the core. And arguably, the health effects from that are just a tiny, tiny fraction of what the hysterics were claiming would be the case.
Right.
So we've seen the worst possible reactor accident you can have is undoubtedly Chernobyl. About the only way you could make it worse would be to drop an A-bomb on it. But then again, the A-bomb is going to be part of your problem.
Sounds to me like you ought to redo that book or, you know, eventually come out with a book because you have some interesting facts and scenarios you've just laid out.
About a couple of things?
Sure. Please.
With respect to the anti-nuclear movement, there is a developing schism in the anti-nuclear movement.
Yay!
And this is something you might want to look at. There is a group called Environmentalists for Nuclear Energy. One of the board members is James Lovelock, who developed the Gaia hypothesis. Lovelock also talks about the waste disposal, and he also talks about the French experience in Gabon with what are called the Oklo natural reactors. That's what I talked about earlier. So Lovelock, who is a believer in global warming catastrophe, is strongly, strongly pro-nuclear for environmental reasons. There are other prominent environmentalists who were anti-nuke who have changed their position, and the most recent is a fellow who is the environmental writer for The Guardian named George Monbiot.
Hmm.
He came out with an article, I think, maybe a month ago, month and a half, 2 months, in which he said that as a result of the Fukushima Daiichi accident, he is now pro-nuclear because he actually drew the correct conclusion that, yes, they melted down three reactor cores and the system was so much safer that than he expected that, in effect, it demonstrates that nuclear power is very, very safe. Now, it wasn't so safe for the stockholders, but those reactors went through a 9 Richter earthquake and a tidal wave, and even though they were functionally destroyed, they did not injure the public. There's really nothing else you can say in favor of nuclear power. So I think serious environmentalists, as opposed to the crazy lunatics, are taking a second look at nuclear, and they're saying, hey, it's actually clean, we can deal with the waste, it's actually safe, and it's actually cheap if you're allowed to build the plants in a reasonable amount of time.
Makes sense to me. Of course, I'm not a scientist, but when I listen to your reasoning, I like where you're coming from. Could you now comment on what's going on in, I guess it's Kansas or Nebraska, where there's some nuke problems out there, nuclear plant troubles out there?
You mean there was some talk about flooding or something? And
yes. I thought they had some serious problems out there. I mean, I haven't heard too much about it, but I thought they had some, probably they're older nukes too. I mean, are there any American nukes less than 40 years old?
Well, I'm not up on my list of operating nukes in the United States. Even though the last licenses were granted in the late 70s, there were nuclear power plants being built and coming online over the succeeding years. I don't know when the last of the reactors in the pipeline was built.
Okay.
But you know, maybe within the past 10 years, maybe within the past 15. I just don't have the information in front of me, and there was a time when I could probably have recited, most of the reactors in the country, but I can't do it anymore.
Okay.
But I mean, if you look it up, you can probably Google search it. In 5 or 10 minutes, you can find out what is the most recent nuclear power plant that went operational in the U.S. I'm guessing 10 to 15 years.
Let me ask you about finance. Given that they're, they get the go-ahead, the permits from the sacred government, couldn't they be built with private money or private going to the banks or loans or investment?
It should be. As always, the bureaucratic philosopher kings make use of the tax code and various and sundry other regulatory schemes in order to promote favored industries, favored technologies. Nuclear power is sort of a classic example of the government giving with one hand and taking away with the other.
True.
So, on the sticking with the hand metaphor, on the one hand, you had the federal government capping damage. There was the Price-Anderson Act.
Correct.
And so that capped the possible damage award against a nuclear power plant. Then there were also various subsidies for accelerated depreciation and a whole bunch of other things that were used to promote that particular industry. But at the same time, then you had a regulatory agency that created ever more stringent guidelines for the siting and operation of nuclear power plants. I mean, here's a fascinating one.
Jeez.
The amount of radiation given off by a typical coal plant is actually greater than the amount of radiation given off by a typical operating nuclear power plant in the United States.
Huh.
Now that sounds utterly absurd, but there is a certain amount of uranium and thorium just present in the crust, and it's present in coal. And so when you burn the coal, you throw some of that out into the air, and it turns out that it's more radioactive than what is permitted to be emitted from a nuclear power plant.
I don't find that those facts surprising at all. Let me ask you briefly about coal. I hear the term clean coal. Paul, with where we are today with technology in 2011, is it true that, I mean, wouldn't coal burn a lot more cleaner? Isn't there a way to, as far as using it also, to make it burn a lot more cleaner?
Oh, there are probably various and sundry things you can do. The big movement in the late 60s and up through the 70s was the application of scrubber technology to pull sulfur dioxide out of the coal.
I remember that.
No, that's well understood. And
is it good science? Does it work?
Well, yeah, sure, it works. But there's sort of a law of diminishing returns, and that is that beyond a certain point, you greatly increase the amount of money you're paying to get more sulfur out of the coal. So I really don't buy into it. I think that there's no need to further push it. That's my position on it. I think coal is adequate, and I personally, I have no problem with burning coal. Given my
really
brothers,
close to it.
I would prefer a nuclear power plant, but in the final analysis, let's let the economics of it determine which one you should use. I personally think advanced reactors could completely replace coal plants, and it would be advantageous. There are a lot of advantages to nuclear.
But I'm very pro natural gas too.
Yeah, I like natural gas. Of course, we've got huge deposits and improved methods of recovery. I've always been rather bullish on gas turbines,
sure.
In particular for automotive propulsion. So you could run cars on small gas turbines, turbine electric systems that would be very efficient. Or you could run them on diesel too, I suppose. But in principle, you could run them on natural gas. And the technology there is really, really impressive. Full disclosure: I'm also invested in a gas turbine, micro gas turbine company.
Good for you. And ideally, millions of other people would invest in it, and we would de-tax these companies and let the market, get rid of the market barriers and let folks invest. I mean, that's the essence of it.
Yeah. Now let me say something bad about Obama. But it seems as though just about every time Obama opens his mouth, you see more jobs lost. You see companies die.
Sorry, Mike.
You see companies that decide, gee, since we can't open a new plant in a different state in the United States, maybe we'll open a plant in China. It's utter insanity.
Who can blame them?
Yeah, you can't. You can't. And in the final analysis, if I own stock in a company, I want them to do whatever they can, that company can, to maximize the bottom line. And this is probably as business-unfriendly an administration as the United States has had since FDR. In a way, it's actually worse because I don't think that FDR was malevolently anti-capitalist the way Obama is.
Yeah.
Obama hates the system. FDR was just kind of stupid. But I see Obama as being malevolent.
Yeah, and of course, he also wants a government program or everything, or tax for this or tax, it's as if the state should, it is, in his way, to control everything. He's much more a corporatist like Mussolini. He would, FDR looked towards Mussolini's economic plan. Obama is they call him a socialist or a Marxist. Well, he's more of a right-wing socialist, the fascistic corporatist. He's behind the scenes. He's bailed out his corporate buddies. He's, it's a facade. It's a facade.
And you raised another good point. You've raised another good point. You remember I said that Obama, there were reasons why Obama was pro-nuclear?
Right.
Back when he was getting his start in Illinois, one of his biggest contributors through, you know, bundling of corporate money and so forth,
sure.
You know, corporate executives and so forth, I think his largest contributor was a company called Exelon. It used to be Commonwealth Edison, the largest privately owned nuclear utility in the world. So Obama may well be an embodiment of what Robert Heinlein called an honest politician. He does seem to stay bought. So he was bought and paid for by Exelon, and he's paying him back.
And now, also,
as I say, I don't care.
Well, it's good to know this. I mean, I want, contrary to what he supposedly stood for, was transparency.
Yeah.
Now, isn't this also true, Paul, for these other green technologies that are, you know, the people who push them, hypocritically enough or ironically enough, is often the corporate interests who stand to gain from it?
Yeah.
With this whole light bulb thing.
That's true. Emult apparently is going to be making money from Chinese production of these compact fluorescents.
It's just so obvious.
Yeah, it's the problem with this is it was something that it took me a while to discover, but I finally did, and that is that any bureaucracy is going to become self-serving and corrupt, and its primary focus becomes on self-preservation and rent-seeking.
Oh, of course.
And that means that they all ultimately become political entities. And so if an administration comes in that can play to a particular bureaucracy's natural tendency to expand itself, then you have a very potent weapon. So in the case of Obama, well, let's just deploy the NLRB, and we can go after Boeing.
Awful.
And in the case of say, other favored companies, well, you know, maybe there are things that you can do to take advantage of the Environmental Protection Agency, which certainly wants to expand itself.
I can't stand those bastards.
To create entry barriers for certain technologies and reward others. And so it's ideal for a sort of a corporatist fascist, which I think you're right. I think you're right in describing Obama in those terms.
Well, Ron Paul refers to him long ago as a corporatist.
What'd you say?
Ron Paul has referred to Obama years ago as a corporatist. You know, I mean, he bailed out, you know, GM, the unions. The unions and management are in lockstep together as far as protectionism goes and corporate welfare.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that's a fair characterization. But at the same time, I don't want to abandon what I was saying before, that I do see that on a very fundamental level, Obama is virulently anti-capitalist. I see for him this corporatist fascism is sort of a means to an end. It's a step. This is how we get to our end goal.
Yeah.
So being at this stage a corporatist serves his interest. I see him as being more a Hugo Chavez type, ultimately, or a Robert Mugabe type.
Well, here's the thing, and it goes back even before all this Obama hysteria, that a lot of big businesses, I am not pro-business. Let me say, I am not pro-business per se. I am pro-free enterprise. There's a big difference.
Agreed.
And a lot of big business or big companies, and you've probably heard this before, and this is true, and this is an overview of what you're saying, actually,
right,
is that they want socialism for themselves and capitalism for everybody else. You know, we want the government privilege gravy train. Y'all,
yeah,
the rest of you, you compete.
Sure. And you can understand it. it's perfectly predictable that human beings are going to behave that way. If you begin to create any particular kind of economic environment, what's the smart business going to do? It's going to adapt. It's going to adapt in whatever way benefits it.
That's
one of the strengths of the free market. But you pervert that sort of creative strength once you involve government in the whole process.
Very true. That's my big problem. Here's the problem, Paul, is that this kind of business activity with the barriers to market entry and their political privilege and their bailouts and their crony capitalism, this gives a very bad name, and it perverts the real honest meaning of what capitalism is.
Yes, it does. It does.
True capitalism does not allow bailouts, corporate welfare, crony capitalism, state capitalism, corporate socialism, corporate welfare. And I always rail against those things. It's the perversion of it. I used the example the other day to a very learned guest that liked my example. Was that, for example, you own a car, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that car is wonderful. It suits its purposes. But the minute Paul... I'm not saying you're going to do this, but if Paul was to use that car to rob banks, to run down innocent pedestrians, to just be a total idiot, then you've ruined the purpose of what that car is all about. And that's what's happened to capitalism. And as a man of integrity, I will always carry the banner of true free market capitalism, and I will always turn against the perversion of it and the crony capitalists and this whole crowd. And that's where I can't be bought and I can't be intimidated. I will never condone what they're up to.
Agreed.
Yeah. So I definitely want to have you back on again sometime, because we can take it past the nuke thing. And what's interesting to me is that I think you referred to yourself as a bit of a Johnny come lately with the economics. But since you have this background in science and technology and your wisdom about nuclear power and nukes, it'd be interesting to get your take, now that you know more about economics, how that has played into your thought process about financing these undertakings, and just what you've learned, your journey, if you will. I find that interesting because years ago I used to talk to you about Mises and Austrian economics, and you never were a snob or rude or anything like that. You just hadn't really got to check much of it out, and understandably, because a lot of your study background and your work was toward the physical sciences and this and that.
Right.
So now you're integrating some of this other stuff, and I think it's very interesting to hear how you've come, I don't know if I want to say full circle, or what you've discovered along the way. I know that last year you completed reading Hayek's The Road to Serfdom.
And that was the first time I'd read anything by Hayek. And what fascinated me in reading it was the extent to which I was there. So
right.
I thought, well, gee, maybe if I'd read this 30 years ago, I would have gotten where I am now a little faster. On the other hand, it's the process, this sort of evolutionary process I've gone through has, I think it's been useful. I think I said this before. I see myself as a sanity check. In a sense, I came at things in my own way, following my own path, and sort of turning over the information as I came upon it and examined it. And I think that's been useful. I think having that different perspective is beneficial, particularly when I hang out
agree.
With fellow libertarians.
Right, I agree, but people come to libertarianism from many different angles, and
yeah.
Yours came from more of the scientific background and understanding of nuclear power background, and that's very important, because we need that sort of thing. And I forgot to mention this earlier. I'm kind of deviating here, Paul, but Paul, it's been over a year now since the big oil spill in the Gulf. We don't hear much about it anymore.
No, it pretty much dissipated, didn't it?
Apparently, Paul, it wasn't the end of the world either, like so many. Not to say
no,
the end of the world,
no.
But it wasn't, you know. And I think BP was pretty fair in the way they treated people or paid for their damages. However, I was totally against them giving $20 billion to the federal government to disperse, however they did that. I would have rather dealt with the states of, you know, Mississippi or Louisiana and just dealt with the people locally.
That's the way it should have been, yeah. I see BP as an example of a company that was seduced and abandoned by the Obama administration.
Oh, definitely. This guy is something else, what he gets away with. So it's going to be interesting when he pulls his guns out for re-election because, you know, a lot of people just support him blindly. Although I think some of Black America is waking up to the charlatan that this guy is. And he just gets away with so much. So it just... who knows? It'll be interesting next year.
Yeah, I agree.
You know? So what I would like to do now is, as I wind down, I want to thank you so much for coming on, Paul. I appreciate your time. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed it. And
yeah, fun.
You have a lot of knowledge and experience, so I want to exploit some of that in the future when I invite you back. And I'm glad you were able to, come for this time zone, because I know, like you, a lot of other people, your work doesn't allow. I have a late night show, so, but it's wonderful that I can pre-record. It's actually more relaxing, although I do miss, you know, whatever calls come in. But I definitely want to have you back in the future. And then a couple other things I want to talk about with you, which I know that you're really up on, is the nonsense of this insane drug war. And the rights and liberties that we're losing as Americans that people don't even realize, perhaps.
Yeah, you can direct people to some of my writing on the web about drugs.
Sorry, Paul. Please.
There's a piece I wrote called "Marijuana Myths."
Please, Paul. Excuse me. Right now, why don't you give a shout out to any of the sites that you want to direct people to? Please do.
Just type my name, Paul Hager, H-A-G-E-R, and Marijuana Myths, and you'll come across something I wrote about 20 years ago, and then I think I updated it maybe 15 years ago, something like that. And I think it's kind of stood the test of time with respect to the kind of myths that have been used to demonize cannabis. So that's one of the things I've written. I haven't really been as involved in the drug war issue in recent years. Been more involved with Second Amendment self defense.
Yes, but you can also
kind of an interesting story in and of itself.
You can always speak eloquently about the drugs because really nothing's changed. It's the same principles, the same nonsense that they're up to. And excuse me, and the other irony, actually coming from your background, is you're a very pro-Second Amendment person, which must make a lot of the environmentalists wet their pants also. So,
yeah,
you know.
Although I didn't used to be. Prior to 1993, I was not.
Uh-huh.
So that's a story in and of itself. You can have me on and we can talk about that. If people are interested, go to paulhager.org, and you'll come up on my main website, and it's called Why I Carry. And that talks about how I changed from being a gun prohibitionist to being pro-Second Amendment.
Great. You've had
more of that evolution.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you've had these interesting journeys, and you are wise enough, and... what's the word I'm trying to find? That you were able to look at some of your positions and say, you know what, I need to alter this because I was incorrect about this.
Yeah. Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
For me, I would really advocate this approach for other people. There is nothing quite as exhilarating as learning something new, and that often means that you have to discard old, wrong ideas. So being proven wrong is a wonderful, wonderful, enlightening and enlivening experience. And so for me, finding out that everything I thought I knew about guns and the meaning of the Second Amendment was wrong, well, that was a wonderful revelatory experience. The same thing about economics and areas in science. It's all the same. So I would recommend that people not become so ego-involved with a position. Don't fall in love with a particular belief.
Right. Well, you have more of a rational ego will let you take this journey and self-check and say, well, you know, I need to discard this because I was incorrect about this. So, yeah I really see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
So, and with that, I'm going to say thank you very much again, Paul, for coming on Third Stream View. I enjoyed having you on here. We got plenty to talk about in the future. Please promise me you'll come back again soon.
Will do. Thanks a lot.
In fact, I'm going to see you in a few weeks, and I'm going to take you out to dinner on my dime.
Done.
Thank you, sir. Have a good
one. Looking forward to it.
You should. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all again for coming back to have a listen at Third Stream View here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern here at Third Stream View. I'm your not-so-humble host, PK, signing off, and you can check us out again next week on Third Stream View. Good night, everybody. You know.